Okay, Jonathan, can you introduce yourself?
Okay, my name is Jonathan, and I was born in 1972 in an Israeli Air Force base. My father was a fighter pilot there. My mother was a teacher back then and a biologist. And they raised me to be a good Zionist boy, go to the army and protect our country, the only democracy in the Middle East. How's that for an introduction? long story short, just like my father, I wanted to be a pilot, and after high school I did a year of volunteering with the communities in the south, and then I joined the military when I was 19 and finished the pilot course at the end of 1993 as a rescue helicopter pilot. And I was quite proud of what I do. I rescued many people, brought people to hospital from car accident, from suicide attacks, from Lebanon, soldiers and civilians, and flew commando troops. But slowly, in a long process, I became aware of what today I say, that I was part of a terrorist organization. It's a very difficult process for someone that grow up in this atmosphere of we defend our country and all this stuff, to realize that something that I like to do the most, that give me so much joy and power and excitement, is actually connected to what I really hate in this world and is harming and oppressing and killing innocents. And exactly 16 years ago, today, the 22nd of July, 2002, I was just thinking about it yesterday when we left Palermo. It was the night between the 21st and the 22nd of July, 2002. The Israeli Air Force dropped a one-ton bomb on the house of Salah Shchadeh, one of the leaders of the Hamas in Gaza, in one of the most dense populated neighborhoods, in an assassination mission. They killed 15 people, among them about 9 children and babies, and I think also a woman that was also pregnant. And to me, it was like the last piece of puzzle that came down from the earth with this one-ton bomb to complete the picture and to tell me, where do I live? What is my job? Who are my friends? Who are my commanders? Who are my leaders? This moment of realization is like a punch in your face, like finding out that your father is a child molester or something horrible like that. It was a process of awakening, and I had to start learning a lot and teaching myself huge part of reality that was I was blind to, that I was in denial of. The history I learned in school was half-sided history that did not include what happened to millions of people and what is happening now to millions of people. And that led me to organize what was later called the Pilot's Letter. In 2003, we refused to participate in the occupation and in the oppression. Although I never directly bombed or killed anyone, I feel that I had a huge responsibility. Everyone can say, I'm not doing the actual murder. I'm just I'm just cleaning around. I am just bringing the people back to hospital after. But for me, it was clear that once I'm part of an organization that is doing this kind of killing and murdering of people, I have an obligation. And that basically changed my life completely. I remember my girlfriend at the time asked me, so how long are you going to do these kind of things? And it was a few days after we published the pilot's letter. And I remember looking at her, sitting by the computer, doing emails and answering reporters and stuff. And I said, you know what, 6 weeks and I'm done and I'm back to my life. And it's 15 years since then.
Wonderful. Let us go back to the small boy you were, let's say, beginning of the 80s. Did you ever see a Palestinian or never?
I remember my Arabic teacher in elementary school. We studied Arabic from fourth grade. And his name was Mamdouh El-Hajj from Wadi Ara in the north, in the close to the Galilee, close to Haifa. And I remember that my mother wanted to help the school and suggested the manager to the principal to organize a trip to Mamdouh's village so the kids will be introduced to Palestinian kids. We didn't call them Palestinians, we called Arab Israelis back then. That's how they, the Zionists talk. And I remember that there were some trying to do that, but eventually other parents didn't want, so they didn't do that. I talked to few construction workers in my neighborhood, and I remember trying to brag that I can count till 10 in Arabic or something like that. But I didn't really, other than that, I didn't really have much more than these few encounters here and there. And of course, not an encounter with someone that can face me with reality. It was either a teacher in school that is probably concerned about his position and will not start to tell the kids that they are being lied. A construction worker who, you know, wants to keep his job and not to upset a little upper middle class kids passing by. So look at the seagull. Yeah, he's coming to say hi. So I didn't have much contact, and the few I say that it's like cracks in the narrative. The few cracks in the narrative happened during the later years of the Lebanon War, as a 15, 16 years old boy. I started seeing all this stuff, and I was always kind of Zionist lefty against the settlement and the occupation, but not in a very active way. And I remember meeting sometime, like when I was 18, I met in the library somewhere a guy that told me he's an author that was fighting with the Haganah in 48, and they did horrific things in Lid, Ramle and Lid, where there was massacres. It was just a strange grandpa sitting in the library telling me these crazy stories. And I was always someone that is eager to listen to stories and to talk to people. But this was one of the first time I ever heard about these things. We learned in school about the massacre in Kufr Qasim that happened in 57. As a lesson, and also in the youth movement. I was in this socialist Zionist youth movement, and we learned about that, and it was all about peace. And but the bad guys was always were always the Likud, the right wing parties, the settlers, the revisionist, the Irgun, the Haganah, and the Palmach were the good guys that were always careful not to harm innocents. And the Lehi and Etzel, the Stern Gang, and all these guys were the bad guys that were attacking innocents. And it was the spectrum. So you can be either on the left, wanting peace, and for the Palmach, Haganah, and these militias, or on the right, you know, with Begin and with Sharon and with all these guys that made the impression that this is the choice we have, left and right. It took me, many years to realize that this both the scale was all deep in the swamp, far, far right, giving me the impression that I have a choice between left and right.
Let's go back to the young teenager. Does this statement that God gave this land for Jewish play a role in your understanding when you were very young?
It's funny because I was never religious, but our family was always like doing Kabbalat Shabbat and celebrating the holidays. And my grandfather, taught me some stuff in the Bible, and I did the bar mitzvah, but in a secular way. But I remember as a child, I think it was third grade, when I was 9 or 10, you study Torah, you study the Bible in all the schools, you know, even the non-religious school. And we came to the chapter when Joshua and the 12 tribes are, you know, conquering Canaan from all the different people that lived there.
Josué.
And about all the tactics and the spies that they left, all the biblical story, how it all happened, and about the Yevusi, Knani, all these different nations that lived, according to the Bible, of course. And for me, it was kind of, like you learn Greek mythology, but I know it's very much connected to my roots and everything. And one day I was thinking about it, because we started learning about all the fights, all the battles of the Bnei Israel, the Hebrew tribes coming into Canaan. And I remember thinking to myself, next time we study the Bible class, I will ask the teacher this interesting question that I have in my mind. And I was kind of preparing for this question for several days until the day of the class came. And the question was, how come the tribes, the Israelite tribes, are coming to Canaan and take over everything and kill everyone and take it to themselves? What is the explanations for that? And I thought, wow, this is a smart question. Probably we'll do a long discussion in class and people will say what they think. I was kind of excited, and I was kind of a nerdy student that was liking to, you know, say things that the teacher will like and say, good question, Jonathan. But the teacher, the Bible teacher that day, listened to my question and said, according to the Bible, everything is everything belongs to God. So God can decide to give it to one and take it from the other. Period. And that was the end. And I remember I was like listening with my mouth open, a bit shocked that it was such a quick, yeah, God, ta-dun, ta-dun. And she was not a religious woman, but she was like, I guess, giving me the textbook answer. But this question, I guess, lingered on and on, although I don't believe in the stories of the Bibles, you know, it's connected to some mythology of different tribes and, you know, who knows, like Jesus and other stories. But I think this question came back to me after many years, realizing that, yeah, it's actually the fundament of a lot of the craziness, like, and I can give it in an example about my grandmother. My grandmother was total secular when it comes to religion, like typical like Christianity, Judaism. Of course, she was a Jew coming from Poland, and so she didn't believe in God, but she full-heartedly believed that He gave us the land. And this is Zionism, secular Zionism, like the main movement that started it all. You don't believe in God, you leave the shtetl, you reject the tradition, the Jewish life, but you take one thing, which is the promise from this creature that you don't believe in, this entity that you don't believe in, that he gave you this land, and you just take it over.
Do you think your grandmother feels there was some kind of non-coherence?
Maybe she did, but it didn't bother her when she was supporting Jewish settlement in Hebron and the Temple Mount loyalties. I have at home a picture, like a declaration with a framed picture with like a certificate of honoring her by the Temple Mount loyalties. Ne'emanei Harabait is this group of freak zealots that wants to demolish the Al-Aqsa and build the temple. So my grandmother, the secular woman that left her family in Poland when she was 14, 15 years old and became a pioneer, chalutza, and built roads and everything, later on became a supporter of the Temple Mount loyalists.
Let's jump to the letter of the pilot. Were you already at that time in touch with other anti-colonialists, or did you do by yourself?
It was a graduate process, but when I started researching and teaching myself about the situation, it was like a flood of information. A flood of information that everywhere I looked at, in every direction, I could see a book, a movie, a person, an organization. And you see that actually under the surface, everything is bubbling. And I can learn so much from people that have been struggling for years and years and years. And I started meeting people. And I saw this professor speaking somewhere, and I said, oh, let's go and meet with him. And I met with him, and he gave me his take. And then we drafted the letter, so I went to some people and showed them, and they suggested this and that. And so it was, it was like an amazing, I say that it's like, in few months, or a year or so, I took an intense course in university in many, many subjects. history, sociology, psychology, political science, media work. Like, you have to kind of quickly learn lots of stuff and find your allies, find people that support your feeling, your ideas, and help you put words and principles into what you feel in your guts. Because it started from feeling this disgusting feeling in my guts that something here is so wrong, but I still didn't know exactly to explain it. It takes long time. Even after we published the letter, I still didn't know so many things. And even now, of course, you have to realize that you're all the time learning. But I was not totally aware. I was totally not aware of, like, the Nakba
not aware.
I knew a little bit, but it was the Zionist version of the story. I didn't know that where I live, next to Tel Aviv, it's on the agriculture field of Jlil al-Qibliya. I didn't see all these things because you are being taught not to see. So it was just a year after we published the letter. We published it in the Rosh Hashanah of 2003, in the new Jewish year. And a year later, I was speaking in a conference of the European Social Forum in London. And I gave a speech, and like, people were giving me a lot of support. And I felt really, respect. And it was a nice feeling after you get all the, accusation and being called traitor and stuff. So it was nice to go outside and get this support, and people were clapping, and I was feeling good about myself. And then there was a period of questions and answers, and one woman raised her hand and said, it was like maybe 4,000 people there, and said, I have a question to the pilot. And she said, in 82, I was leaving Sabra or Shatila the morning after the massacre or something like that, and I stepped over the dead bodies of my family and relatives and friends. What do you have to say to us, the millions of Palestinian refugees that are waiting to come back home? It was like, boom, I didn't think about it at all. I didn't know so much about it. I didn't read a lot about it. I was like talking about refusing, and it's important to, not to participate in the occupation, blah, blah, blah. But here is something way bigger than just these words. And I remember that I didn't really know the answer to what she said, but, I think I just tried to speak straight out of my heart, and I told her and the people that I will never feel comfortable at my home until she feel comfortable at her home. And it was a beginning for me. I was still not part of the movement like today. We are calling for the right of return and teaching Israelis and people about the Nakba, and being active member of a small amount of Israelis that are calling for the full right of return of Palestinians. But that's how I started. That was my first steps, and it was very humbling, I think, if I'm using this word in the right way, to remember that you always don't know. And even if you feel that you did a very important and courageous step, you might be still more ignorant than what you think. So I carry this feeling with me now when I'm with you on the way to Gaza to break the blockade. There are probably so many other things that I am still not aware of, that has to do with struggles and inequality and my privilege as a white male man, so, yeah.
Now we are in 2000.
I told you that I'm talking too much.
No, not too much. It's just no, so important. No, really.
We will shorten it. Yeah.
No, we will because it's why it is on sound and not video.
So you can compress it.
Yeah. We are in 2018. So now, how Jonathan sees the situation, and tell again about this movement which is rising for the right to return. How do you place yourself?
Today, for me, it's not anymore the occupation and two-state solution, all these things. It's part of the two states and the whole occupation style philosophy is became not a two-state solution, it became two-state problem that people are holding on ideas that are not going to bring us anywhere good, and not, of course, to equality and not to justice. Today I'm part of those people around the world and in Israel and Palestinians and Jews that believe that the one state solution is the way to go, even if we know that it will take time to get there. I believe in equal rights for all, and there is a oxymoron to think that you can have a Jewish supremacy democracy. You know, it's like in Athens, let's have a democracy only for the men, but women and slaves are out. So if you want to do a democracy like in Athens, you can, but it will be more an apartheid than a democracy. There is an organization called the Zochrot in Israel that was started by a friend of mine and other activists, Eitan Brunstein. You probably know him. And now Eitan, with his wife Eleonore, started a couple of years ago Decolonizer, which is another organization that basically a similar goal of maybe we'll just see that she's okay. So today there are different organizations like I described that their goal is to teach Israelis about the Nakba, but also, like Eitan and Eleonore are doing, try to decolonize these Jewish supremacy ideas from the minds of the Israelis, and to actually like do direct actions of coming to the ruins of the villages with someone that is still alive from the refugees. There are internal refugees that can just hop on a car and come into the place, and you can locate the places where everything was, and where the house was and the school, and we know that it's not that the right of return will happen in a year from now and we will start rebuilding the villages, but it's a process that we do believe is essential for the future solution, justice and peace. There is a research by I think Abu Sita, who's a history professor, that according to his research, it's more than 90% of the refugees or the places that were expelled and demolished in 48 that are still on open land, either agricultural fields or forests by the JNF and stuff like that. But the conflict of people that are actually living in the place where Palestinians were kicked out is maybe just 10 or maybe less percent of all the refugees. So the implementation of the right of return
with the answers, so you don't have to sort from a lot of stuff.
Okay. It's just perfect because it's so sensitive question. So
yeah. So yeah, in general, I am part of the movement of one state, equal rights for all, right of return, and no superiority whatsoever by any religion or national group. I know it's not easy. I know it's a process that will take lots of efforts and time and maybe things like truth and reconciliation things, but we are aiming there, and aiming to the right direction, in my opinion, can help you battle better the current thing. Of course, we will still have lots of problem. We have inequality, economic inequality between people, you know, in the nation group, like between Jews and Palestinians, we have lots of problems that will not be solved just by that. But the idea is equal rights, human rights, and the rest will come along through that.
A last question. The very new law has been passed at the Knesset, that part of the solidarity movement feel as being the first step into legalization of apartheid. How do you explain that? Well, it passed and nothing happened very strongly in Israel against that.
Practically, the new law doesn't have much like changes, but it's the spirit of it. And as you said, it's institutionalizing apartheid, which is maybe... it's bad, of course, but it maybe has also some positive thing. I think one of the most difficult thing for us is to convince countries like France and like England and like other countries that are full of criminality policy themselves. But one of our issues is to convince them that Israel is not a democracy. So maybe in some way this law will put a clear title above the state of Israel, which is an apartheid. It's an apartheid of a group of Jewish supremacists that are now in some kind of a party. You know, they celebrate because they have no resistance within. The opposition is not opposition, you know. It's also Zionist. They call themselves a Zionist camp, so there is no real opposition. The more lefty opposition is way too weak. So they are in a kind of a feast and a party, and they can put in law all the practices that Israel used for decades of Jewish-only settlements and Jewish-only towns and cities. That's the practice. So, in a way, I see also some positive stuff about that.
Thank you so much, Chantal.